This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Tomorrow, a monument to the Groveland Four will be unveiled on the lawn of the historic Lake County Courthouse in Tiveres. The four African-American men, Ernest Thomas, Charles Greenlee, Samuel Shepard and Walter Irvin, were wrongly accused of raping a white woman, Norma Padgett, in 1949. They were posthumously pardoned in 2019 by the Florida Clemency Board, which called their convictions and treatment a miscarriage of justice. Vivian Shepard is the niece of Samuel Shepard, who was shot dead by Lake County Sheriff Willis McCall while he was being transported back to Lake County for a retrial. I spoke to Vivian Shepard about the significance of the monument. She said growing up, her family didn't talk much about what had happened to her uncle.
In my family, my dad never wanted to talk about it. We would ask questions. We would see a picture here and there of Sam, and he would just say, "I don't want to talk about it." And we honored that. Till when he passed, it got to a point where things got a little bit more curious for me. I was living in Gainesville and happened to be home. I think it was like a Memorial Day, and I was laying on my couch and sleep there, and then I woke up and I saw my uncle's picture on the television, and I was like thinking I was dreaming, and I'm like, why is he on television? So I immediately called my mom and I asked her, what is going on? And it was a Harry T. Moore documentary, and I was like, well, I've never heard of this before. I never known. And she told me, yeah, they had a documentary out. And so then I got more curious about it. You know, for some, you may feel like you're a little shame. I did, in a sense. I felt shame because I didn't know my family story. When I moved back home is when I began to see Gary's book. And I read Gary's book. That was like 2012, I think it was. 2013 is when I read Gilbert's book. And I totally wanted, you know, to get involved and do something. This just didn't sit right with me. And so I've been fighting for this ever since then.
What do you think Friday is going to be like for you and I guess for the other family members as well? Is this going to be an emotional day?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm feeling it already. And the closer we get, we're just excited. You know, again, we are thankful and really just looking forward to that ultimate celebration of exoneration, because that is our goal. And we plan on getting them exonerated. It's been too long, but we're willing to hold on and do what our mission is set out to do. So we're looking to have a great day on Friday.
And that was Vivian Shepard, the niece of Samuel Shepard. She'll be at the unveiling of the monument to the Groveland Four in Tiveres on Friday. State Senator Geraldine Thompson has been a longtime champion for the families of the Groveland Four, and she's still fighting to clear their names. She tells me the memorial is a significant step for Lake County, but there's still work to be done to confront the history of racial injustice in Florida. Representative Thompson, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So just walk us back, if you would, and remind us, Representative Thompson, why it is that you've been so personally involved and invested in this story, in this case.
I've been personally involved because of the families of the Groveland Four who contacted me at this point 6 years ago to ask if I would take some steps to clear the names of their relatives and have history accurately record that they were not guilty of the crimes for which they were tried and convicted in some cases, and in other cases where people lost their lives. The family members had contacted then-Governor Rick Scott and asked if he would, by executive order, exonerate the Groveland Four, and the governor took no action on that request. He later sent information to the Attorney General, Pam Bondi, asking her to look at the matter, and she took no action. So that led the families to me, because I have a long history in the state of Florida for social justice and human rights, and they asked me to file legislation, which I did in 2014.
And so it's been kind of like a six-year process from the start of your involvement, but was this a story that you were familiar with all the details of before that even?
Yes, even before I was contacted by members of the family, I had read Gary Corsair's book regarding the Groveland Four, and I had read another account of the Groveland Four situation in a publication called Crusaders in the Courts. And that focused on the role of Paul C. Perkins, Thurgood Marshall, and Jack Greenberg with regard to the Groveland Four. So I was familiar with the situation, which is why I agreed to take some action on behalf of the family.
So what is the significance of the monument then, the memorial that's going to be installed on Friday? What does that mean as far as, you know, where the story's at now and where it goes next?
Well, it'll be a lasting physical reminder that the community recognizes the injustice that was done to the Groveland Four and is now working to rectify that wrong that occurred in 1949 and 1951 when the men were supposed to have a second trial, and one was shot and killed, and the other got a second trial but was found guilty again by an all-white jury and sentenced to death. However, the governor of the state of Florida, Leroy Collins, would not sign a death warrant because of the inconsistencies in the evidence. And then later, Governor Collins commuted the sentence of Walter Irwin, who was the remaining individual at that time, commuted the sentence to life, and later he was released from prison. So this has been something that's over 70 years old that Florida has been grappling with in terms of how do we address what happened with Sheriff Willis McCall, who was an agent of the state of Florida, who in effect was the judge and the jury and the executioner with regard to the Groveland Four.
So it sounds like there's still some work to be done. Like, what do you think will ultimately bring the story to full resolution?
Well, we have continued to make this a visible issue throughout the state of Florida, and we know that in 2019, the very first act of Florida's cabinet was to pardon the Groveland Four. And this followed an apology from the Florida legislature for the racial injustice. So it has been incremental. So we've had an apology. We've had a pardon. But a pardon is what you give to someone who is guilty. You acknowledge that they were involved in an unlawful act, but you extend mercy and you pardon them. These men were not guilty. And so exoneration is the next step and the very necessary step to clear their names and to correctly reflect in history that these men were not guilty.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to Representative Geraldine Thompson about the monument that's being installed for the Groveland Four. Representative Thompson, what is that process of exoneration? How complex is that, and what are the chances for that happening?
Well, right now, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement is undertaking an investigation. They now have access to records and files that they did not have before. And many of those records and files have been released to them or made available to them by Gilbert King, who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Devil in the Grove. He relied on FBI files, records from the physician who examined Norma Paget back in 1949 and did not find evidence of rape. And all of these things were withheld at trial. There were people who said that they saw two of the men in Orange County when the rape reportedly took place. And so now the Florida Department of Law Enforcement has access to these records, and they are conducting an investigation that will then, my understanding is, it will go to the Attorney General, and from there we hope to have a recommendation for exoneration.
And you've obviously been talking to the families throughout this whole process. How do they feel about this monument going up in front of the courthouse in Lake County?
Well, they're pleased. They're pleased to have the monument and to have that community where these atrocities occurred now saying, we want to recognize, we have monuments all over this country recognizing people for all kinds of things. And so here now is a monument recognizing four men whose lives were irreparably damaged because of the actions of an agent of the state of Florida. And these people will now be permanently, through this monument, acknowledged for what they endured and for the fact that they were not guilty of the crime that they were accused of. So the family members are very pleased, and many of them intend to be in Tavares at the courthouse. And ironically, this is the courthouse where Sheriff Willis McCall tortured these men looking for a confession. So to have it in front of that courthouse is very meaningful. And family members will be there to see the unveiling of this monument.
I imagine it's going to be a pretty emotional experience for them then.
Oh, I think so. I've talked with a number of them, and they feel that this removes a cloud from their family. Those who remain have had to endure this record in Florida's history for over 70 years. And so it is freeing for members of the families to now see this monument and to have people recognize that their relatives were not the monsters that they were painted to be. And this redeems redeems not only the Groveland Four, but redeems Lake County, which has finally come to grips with this part of their history.
Let me ask, though, about that, because do you really believe, or do you feel that that actually has happened, or is there still some work to be done there, some reconciliation or some coming to terms with this uncomfortable part of Lake County's past? Because from what I've read, there are some folks who say that they either don't believe the four should be exonerated or should have been pardoned in the first place, or that they feel that this might be better just forgotten and sort of swept under the rug, as it were.
Well, this is a very painful part of Florida's history. And people, I guess it's just human nature, inclination, don't want pain. And so they don't want to look at it. They want to pretend that this has always been a land where people received equal justice under the law and fair treatment, even though we know that that is not the case. So, yes, there are people who'd like to forget it. And then there are others like me and members of the family and people who have been working on this, Gilbert King, who are saying, let's own this and let us now begin healing after we acknowledge that this happened. You cannot correct a problem until you recognize that the problem exists. So if you pretend that it doesn't exist, you'll never have reconciliation and you won't have healing.
And what would you say to Norma Padgett, who really, by all accounts, stands by her account of what happened that day so many decades ago?
Well, the account that has been given about what happened to her changes from day to day. I attended the clemency board hearing during the cabinet meeting January of 11th of 2019, and people were told that she was nude and left standing on the side of the road. There is no record anywhere that this occurred. So I think in her, you know, late 80s, that it's time for Mrs. Padgett to actually tell the accurate truth with regard to what happened.
Do you think that's going to happen? Do you hold out some hope for that?
No, I don't hold out hope for that, because she and a couple of her sons came to the cabinet meeting and asked that these men not be pardoned posthumously. They are all dead and buried, and she is even continuing to this day to say they should not be pardoned. When Gilbert King attempted to interview her for his book, she would not talk about it, and she said, "Let sleeping dogs lie." You can't let sleeping dogs lie when you have people's reputations that have been destroyed, and you can't rely on an account that changes from day to day. She has different versions of what occurred, and there were people who saw her that morning, and, you know, she was fully clothed. She was composed. She made no statements about a rape. So there are just too many inconsistencies. So, no, I don't expect that she is going to step forward and correct this wrong and tell the truth at this point when she hasn't told the truth for 70 years.
Representative Thompson, when you think about the work that you've done for the families of the Groveland Four in your career as a lawmaker, like how important, how significant is this work, do you think?
Oh, it's very significant because it is just one example of a larger problem that Florida has ignored for a long time. Not only are we talking about this kind of thing that occurred, but also in the county where I live, Orange County, we're now shining a spotlight on what happened to July Perry 100 years ago when he went to the polls in Ocoee and attempted to vote for trying to exercise his rights as an American to vote. He was taken to the Orange County Jail, which is in Orlando. But a mob pulled him out, hung him, used his body for target practice. His body was riddled with bullets, and he was left hanging there and finally cut down by a black mortician. He was buried in a pauper's grave. And only now, almost 100 years later, are we beginning to shine the spotlight on the kind of injustices that happened all over this state. So this is one example of this very dark part of our history. But if we don't face it, if we don't discuss it, we will not make the progress that we need to make with regard to reconciliation.
State Representative Geraldine Thompson, thank you so much for your time.
Okay, glad to be here.
Still to come on Intersection, the bid to bring conservative podcast host Ben Shapiro to speak at the University of Central Florida, and why one student senator says it's appropriate to use student fees to help cover the cost of the event. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Conservative podcast host Ben Shapiro is coming to speak at the University of Central Florida next month. We reached out to student senator Michael O'Blenis to ask about the use of student funds to bring the sometimes controversial speaker to campus. O'Blenis proposed the bill to bring Shapiro to UCF. He stopped by the WMFE studio last Friday, a day after he and other student senators voted to approve the bill. Michael O'Blenis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So, tell us about what's going on with this bill, the proposal to bring Ben Shapiro to speak at the student union. What's happening there?
So we actually had the vote on the bill. It was in third reading, and there was a debate during open forum from students that were in favor of the bill and students that opposed the bill. And I think it was a good process for democracy, for sure, for students to come out and voice their opinions.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the night, we voted on the bill 25-15-2. It did pass favorably. And so currently now it's on its way to the student body president's office and also to the vice president of Student Enrollment and Development Services for them to sign off on that so it could be official and those funds could be given to an appropriate department at UCF, and that could be sent over to Ben Shapiro and his camp.
Mm-hmm.
I chose the bill simply because every voice at UCF needs to be heard equally and fairly. I know that there were some rhetoric that it may be too controversial. I don't want to put myself out there on backlash and everything. And so for me, I just took the priority as far as just being a senator, a grad senator, and saying that I will represent these people fairly, objectively, and do the best of my ability to make sure that their bill get passed and that the bill gets funded for them for mm-hmm. their event.
What are your personal feelings about whether or not you would want to hear Ben Shapiro speak? Because you mentioned the controversy, and we can get into a little more detail. Do you think he should be speaking at UCF?
So for me, I am a very open-minded person. In order for me to better understand just the political climate, I need to hear both sides. One of the things I can recall back when I was at Valencia College there a while back, one of my professors, POS professors, he was stating that in order to understand the political climate, you have to reach out to the other side and hear what they have to say. And I look at it as I'm not a person that believes in compromising, but I am a person that believes in finding a common ground. And so if there is rhetoric from Mr. Shapiro that I find a common ground on, I will most definitely go by that. For me, I look at it as it's not going to personally affect me or define who I am. I myself define who I am.
Mm-hmm.
No person on this earth can define who you are.
But having said that, from what you know of Ben Shapiro, has he said things that you would personally disagree with or find uncomfortable?
From what I've heard from Mr. Shapiro, I would find it to be rhetoric that I wouldn't use myself. I think it could be better articulated with a different tone. For Mr. Shapiro, if that's his opinion, that's his position, he has an equal right to believe in that position that he has.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you then about the use of the service fee. The UCF says the activities and service fee is, quote, used to fund activities and services that benefit the general student body, end quote. And to the point about the controversy around Ben Shapiro, he has been known to make those controversial statements that go against who and what UCF supports. So how will bringing Ben Shapiro to UCF benefit everyone there?
I think as far as the student learning outcome, I think it will benefit them quite well. I think that they will realize that what you see behind a camera may not always be, depending upon sound bites. I think nowadays a lot of people just see a lot of sound bites that are on social media and they go run with that. But for sure, this gentleman is going to be speaking a lot longer than that. And I think for the controversy of some rhetoric, I look at it as it's something that you have to say, okay, will this truly cause harm to me physically? If it caused harm to you, you know, mentally or spiritually, then most definitely I would say this is something that will not benefit you if it comes to that degree.
Mm-hmm. But if he's making comments that he's saying things about certain people that they think are wrong or those comments don't represent who they are, for example, he has said that being transgender is a mental disorder. I mean, what kind of message do you think that sends to transgender students at UCF?
I think that does send a message of hurt to them, mm-hmm. For a lot of them. I know there was a gentleman last night that spoke out and said that 5 years ago he couldn't come out and say that he could marry who he has married now. And I totally understand that. And I say to that gentleman or to any person is to let's see if we can find any type of common ground with Shapiro. If there is no common ground, then most definitely do not compromise at all. For those students, I've suggested them to bring bring a speaker that you like, a speaker that you feel that will uplift your position at the university as well.
And have you had some suggestions for alternate speakers?
For me, I not have suggested any alternate speakers. This is a event done by the College Republicans, so it's their event. Mm-hmm. As far as the structure of how the event will go, there will be additional speakers. That's solely up to the College Republicans organization on campus. I do not have a say as a student government senator. The only thing I have is to say that we'll fund this bill or we will not fund this bill on the merits of our fiscal policies.
Mm-hmm. Total cost is $35,750. That includes the $35,000 speaker fee for Ben Shapiro and $750 to cover the cost of 6 UCF police officers. Is
correct.
That right?
Correct.
Some of that money would come from the UCF Senate student fees. I think about half of that, right?
Correct. So out of that $35,000, the UCF Student Government Senate will fund 50% of that, which will be $17,875. And the other half, I think, is for the 6 UCF officers, about $800-some dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the only portion that students will pay. The other half will be paid by the Young American Foundation, mm-hmm. and so they will fund the other 50% of that.
But what would you say to students who say, look, I don't like Ben Shapiro, I don't like anything he represents, I don't want him coming to this campus to speak, please don't spend the money that I've given to the university on this. Like, what's your message to them?
My message to them is clearly, you know, every student pay equally into these fees. It's just not one specific group or one individual that pays the bulk of that $20 million budget for ASF fees for the University of Central Florida. I would say to that student to keep in mind that you would want the same thing done to you as far as your fellow students. I think nowadays we live in a more of me culture, and we need to start thinking about we. And I understand sometimes there can be friction in that we. However, at the end of the day, you have to collectively remind yourself is that we are a university, a public university. Each student pays equally into that fair share pot of ASF fees. And for them to keep in mind that you can do this as well as far as proposing a bill to bring any speaker that you want, long as it just doesn't go over the fiscal policy spending for student government senate at UCF.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I would say to that student.
Are there any lines that you wouldn't cross as far as bringing speakers, like any speakers who would say things that are kind of beyond
yes.
the pale?
So I would most definitely say for speakers that are encouraging just people in general to go out there after he or she speaks to go out there and cause violence to people. And physical violence, that's not allowed at all. I don't believe in creating any type of violence or in encouraging people to commit physical violence upon another person.
But as far as like emotional trauma, that doesn't sort of come to the same level?
For me, I'll be honest, it doesn't. But I understand that there's different people in the world and unique people.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be different for others.
I mean, you must be prepared for some backlash to this, right?
Yes. And so that we are prepared for that. And so a lot of the rhetoric last night was that there's only going to be 6 officers. And from my experience in being a graduate student in the criminal justice program and knowing personally law enforcement officers, I know that there's going to be more than 6 officers in the building around the campus and the perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
How
do you know that for a fact?
Well, as far as knowing that for a fact, I have communicated with some officers at UCF, and they told me that anytime when there is a high-profile speaker or someone of that nature comes through, they do partner up with local other agencies around the Central Florida.
Mm-hmm. And who foots the bill for that?
For that, I'm not aware of. I just know that we as Student Government Senate, we don't foot that bill.
Mm-hmm.
I would assume that that's a collaboration effort between the university and all the other stakeholders.
Mm-hmm.
In that.
Because, I mean, thinking about what happened at Berkeley when Ben Shapiro made an appearance there, people were arrested. There was a lot of tumult, right? I mean, it was not a peaceful occasion.
Right.
So 6 officers does not sound like it may be enough.
Right. And for those that have the concerns, the RSO, the Registered Student Organization, College Republicans, they reached out to UCFPD. And from what they have gathered as far as information going back and forth with UCFPD, UCFPD stated that for 1,000 people to be in the Pegasus Ballroom at the Student Union at UCF, that 6 police officers would be enough. That was stated to the RSO organization. So as far as if there needs to be any other additional officers present, that's something more UCFPD could speak about. Could
they come back to the student government and say, this isn't going to be enough to cover it?
So, yes, they can in a roundabout way. So they can go back to the vice president of student enrollment and student involvement and say, hey, you know, this won't be enough. We need more money. The bill will be vetoed by the VP. And then it could come back to us in a committee and go through the same process again.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that between now and when Ben Shapiro would be scheduled to speak, do you think there's a chance that it may get turned down at some point between now and then?
As far as us as UCF Student Government Senate, we have finalized our part as far as funding the bill. As far as could it be, you know, canceled, that would be more from the administration at UCF, from what they, the information and the evidence that they have that says that, you know, we understand that this bill has been funded by students. However, we have made an executive decision for just the climate at UCF and the surrounding community that this event will be canceled.
Mm-hmm.
So if it will be canceled, it would come from higher ups, not from student government.
Michael Oblenis is a senator for the College of Graduate Studies with the student government at UCF. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Still to come on Intersection, TV guy Hal puts away his remote. A conversation with Hal Boedeker about the changing face of TV and print media, and why he decided now was the time to retire from the Orlando Sentinel. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. For the first time in decades, Hal Boedeker doesn't have to spend his evenings watching TV. The Orlando Sentinel's longtime TV and media critic said goodbye to the newspaper at the end of last month. I spoke to Hal about his life as the TV guy and what comes next. Hal Boedeker, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
So you are coming off of a long career in the newspaper industry, more than 40 years, most of that spent in Orlando.
That is true. Yeah, I got my degree at the University of Missouri-Columbia in 1978. So I've been in the business, you know, 42 years. I was here 25 years. I was remembering, though, that I, before that, like right out of high school, I helped in the process of setting type and delivering newspapers. I worked for a little paper near my hometown, and people affectionately called it the Daily Disappointment. So, and the thing is that, you know, it was like 6 days for a long time. Now it's down to 3 days a week, and sort of the sign of what's happening in the newspaper industry.
But it's still there, which is kind of a miracle in some ways.
It is.
Because a lot of smaller newspapers just haven't been able to survive.
Right.
And large newspapers too.
Right, for sure. Mm. Yeah, I think people say the Daily Disappointment, you'll miss it when it's gone, and, you know.
Yeah. Was it disappointing because you were covering stories that people didn't want to read about, or?
No, I think it was people, the readers. And again, we're talking about in rural Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
They could spot things that weren't right. And you know, people like the information to be correct. And so, you know.
So when you set out at the start of your career, did you sort of foresee yourself in the role that you grew into at the Sentinel as a TV critic?
You know, it's so interesting. I really trained to be a copy editor. And if you understand the way the news business has gone, there's no room for copy editors anymore.
But should there be?
Oh, my God, yes. Oh, yes. Yes, please. I mean, I would say forgive us our typos because, I mean, we need copy editors. And but, reducing the staff, people thought, well, copy editors, you know, they can go. We don't need them. So the thing is, I trained to be a copy editor, and then I fell into writing, like in my first job, which was in South Carolina. And then I did some writing at my second job, which was back in Columbia, Missouri, at a very fine small daily. And then I jumped to the Miami Herald, where I worked nearly 11 years. I was the TV critic there for the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I always thought I wanted to be a movie critic. And the thing was that television is so superior to the movies, and there's just so much more of it, and it really does set the agenda, I think, in a way that the movies don't. I mean,
you were thinking this back before the renaissance of TV, you know, before
right.
we had like Sopranos right. and everything else that kind of kicked off this renewed right. interest in television.
Right. And I started, like, the first year I was a TV critic was 1990, and it, like, Twin Peaks and the Civil War. I mean, those are incredible peaks in television. And then, as you said, you know, The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, mm-hmm. you know, all these really good TV shows, like up through The Big Bang Theory and Game of Thrones, which both ended last year. So, yeah, I mean, I got to see a lot of the TV industry. I used to go to L.A. a lot and talk to people out there and you know, the job changes, and so you shift with it, and that's what I did.
Mm-hmm. What'd you think of the reboot of Twin Peaks?
I didn't pay much attention to it. I thought that was something that you couldn't recapture, mm-hmm. you know? So why revisit that? And at that point, you know, I was looking for shows that people were talking about. And there's just so much television. And at the same time, I was like picking up assignments like on radio mm-hmm. or, you know, stand-up comedians. I've done a lot of stand-up comedians in like the past 4 or 5 years. I was doing movies. I was mm-hmm. doing movie production. I mean, you know, I covered the First Man production junket out here. So it's, you know, it's a balancing act.
Mm-hmm. When you think about stand-up comedians, like the thing now seems to be able to get a Netflix special or an Amazon special, right? That's kind of the gold standard for comedians.
Right.
Any that really have caught your eye and ear over the last couple of years?
Well, I'd rather talk about the people that I just really enjoy talking to, like mm-hmm. Marc Maron. I've got an interview coming up with him. I've got an interview with Lewis Black that should be in the paper this Friday. I left a few things for them mm-hmm. because I was working up to the end. I mean, I loved working and I liked talking to people. It's very interesting to me that, you know, you start, you're going to be the TV critic, you're going to review TV shows, and you stay in a community and you meet people and the local stories become more important. And so, like, in my time there, I would say, you know, some of the most important stories I covered were feature stories. People like, you know, stories about Wendy Chiocci mm-hmm. or, you know, I wrote, you know, appreciations send-offs for Billy Maynes and Scott McKenzie. And so it's, you know, some people have said my secret was that I would adapt, and I did adapt. And I think I've written a lot of fun reviews through the years, but following Wendy Chiocci and her life story was really very moving to me. She was such an inspiring figure, mm-hmm. and you know, and Scott McKenzie, man, what a wonderful human being. And so, it's like you're telling people out there, you know, these people are in our midst. They make our community better. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, it's really thrilling.
And it's interesting too, I'm sure, kind of sitting down and talking to somebody who, you know, you have an image of somebody who's a television presenter because you see them on TV every
right.
day. So people feel like they have this connection with them, right? But then sitting down and having a conversation is different from seeing them, you know, present the evening news, for example.
Well, yeah, they're just people, right? I mean, I've talked to Bob Newhart, you know, man, love Bob Newhart. And so charming, and he ended the interview by singing to me. That's one of the great memories of my career. I said, you know, it's a shame that there weren't lyrics to your 1970 sitcom the way there were for Mary Tyler Moore. And he said, oh, no. And then he sang the lyrics to me. So,
do you have that on tape? Like, are you recording that?
I don't have it on tape.
Oh, man, that's a shame.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, like moments like that. I've had really good interviews. Like, someone who very much impressed me because she was so honest was Candace Bergen. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking to her about the end of Murphy Brown, and she wasn't sugarcoating it. She said, this show had a very uneven run, and you don't get that kind of frankness very often.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like as a TV critic, did it take away some of your just casual enjoyment as a kind of a viewer? Like when you sit down to watch a show, you're like, man, this is work. I'd rather be doing something else.
Well, yes, but you know, at a certain point, you just realize you have to do it, mm-hmm. and you just do it. And yeah, I mean, now it's like, I didn't watch TV last night. I mean, goodness, that's a new feeling, right?
And what did you do instead?
Well, I went out and had a drink. And, you know, it was like, great. I ran into people having conversations at a bar. And, you know, it's, I would say, yes, I watched a lot of television. And let me say, you know, people will say, like it's, you know, it's just fun. And it's not fun. You have to pay attention to what's happening. You have to go back and look at it, really look at it sometimes. And so, yeah, it was work. It was very enjoyable work. Let me tell you, I mean, I come from a family of farmers and ditch diggers, and I much preferred doing what I was doing. So,
some of it's pretty immersive, though, right? I mean, you can disappear into a series. Like, you're really in that other world for a good period of time if you're watching a series.
Yeah, but again, it's like if we talk about Game of Thrones, talk about an uneven run for series two. I mean, that last season. So I think the critic plays an important part. It just can't be about fandom, right? Oh, it was wonderful. It was great. Well, wait a minute. There were problems, right? I mean, it wasn't as, you know, I think we perform an important action or function or whatever you want to say. So,
Is there anything looking back at it where you think, man, I got that wrong? I'd rather go, you know, I need to go back and kind of review that series because my first take on it wasn't what I think now.
Well, you have to understand that in the beginning, that you would only get one or two episodes of a show. And two, if you were lucky. I mean, a lot of the time it's just the first episode. In recent years, you get the whole series before. And who has time to sit down and watch a whole series? I mean, there were like other things to do. Mm-hmm. I will say that I made a really strategic blunder in watching only the first episode of The Sopranos. Because I sat there and I thought, this mob boss, he's whining to the shrink. I mean, about Gary Cooper. I just, you know, oh, who wants to sit there and watch that? Mm-hmm. And it's like my friends were saying, oh, Hal, you've got to go back and watch it. And of course, it was one of the all-time great shows. Now, I hear from people, social media is such an interesting thing. I did not like The Office, the Steve Carell Office. I said, this is not as good as the Ricky Gervais version.
Yeah, it's quite different, isn't it?
It's quite different. And I still think the Ricky Gervais version is much superior. But that's the difference. I mean, you know, they string out shows, string them out. I mean, Grey's Anatomy is still running. Really? You know? So anyway, I just think that if people go back and look at those reviews, you got to remember maybe one episode, two episodes, three episodes, you know, they're living, breathing organisms. They will change like human beings, right?
Let me ask then, Hal, about your decision that, you know, this is the time to move on and start a new chapter in your life. Like, why was it that this was the moment you're like, okay, that's it. I'm done with the Sentinel.
Well, I don't think I'll ever be done with the Sentinel. Let's put it that way. I mean, I'll always cheer them on. I think there's a tremendous staff there. And I think that the management of that newspaper, I think, is about as good as it's ever been. But again, I had been there 25 years. They made the buyout offer on a Monday. And my anniversary was on Thursday of that week. And I just thought, well, this is good. I know I don't look it, but I am 63 years old. So, you know, a little humor there. I think that this was such a good deal and the future is so uncertain. And because of my age, and you'd factor all of this stuff together. And I talked to friends who said, you know, it's time. So, I mean, you have to be a realist about this. So.
And it wouldn't have been the first buyout offer you'd received, I'm sure.
No, but I loved the job so much. I loved it. I mean, like I said, the variety of topics. I mean, I had this blog, you know, and of course the blog, years ago, the editor said, you know, Hal, we think you should write a blog. We think you should spend more time on that. And boy, was that good advice, because TV Guy Hal, the TV Guy blog. You know, that's the reason I had a pretty long run there, because, you know, it didn't matter if I was going to get in the newspaper or not. People were reading me through the blog. And the job sustained me through some really hard times. And for that reason, I will always thank the Orlando Sentinel. I even worry about the deaths of my mother and my brother on my blog. And I think it's really important that people understand that in these industries, we are people. We are everyday people. I think sometimes cable news gives the sense of, well, this is what journalism is. And it's, you know, it's like we're just everyday people talking to people in our community, trying to get ideas out there, trying to make the community better, trying to hold up hypocrisy or you know, explain that why things don't work and how things could work better. So to me, I think journalism is such a noble profession when it is practiced correctly. And I mean, and to me, it's such a strange feeling to hear all these people telling me, well, you were fair. That's like the best feeling in the world, to hear from somebody like, you know, you covered me, you were always fair. We're not elitists. We're everyday people covering the community. And if you have a connection with readers, it's very hard to give that up.
Do you feel pretty good about the future of the Sentinel then, thinking about the paper and the work that is ahead of it?
Yeah, I do. And just look at the big stories they've been doing. Again, I think the managers, the top management there is excellent. Yeah, yeah. You know, who knows what is ahead? But yeah, at this moment, for sure.
I was talking to Eric Deggans, the NPR TV critic, last year, and he made a comment about how the fact there is just so much to watch now.
Right.
For somebody kind of coming into this profession at this point in time, it's a different landscape from when you were getting started, right?
For sure. And in the beginning, the focus was on the broadcast networks. And then, of course, then it shifted more to cable and now at the streaming services. But again, I think the importance of TV, of a TV critic, is to, like, you know, pay attention to this particular show. And even toward the end, I mean, I wrote about The Crown, which I thought was just sublime with Olivia Colman. Mm-hmm. And I wrote about Ken Burns' Country Music, and which I don't know, that made me feel so good. It reminded me how important songs are, song lyrics. I'm the child of a music teacher, and I just thought, of all the people I've covered in the TV industry, Ken Burns holds a special significance for me, because I covered the Civil War, and I covered everything up to country music. That's like baseball and jazz and, you know, a really tremendous Frank Lloyd Wright biography. And he has made such an impression on the culture, reminding us how important history is and making it entertaining, making it involving.
So what's next for you, Hal? What do you think you'll be doing in the next little while?
I'm relaxing. Like I said, I really am relaxing. This sense of, like, I don't have to write anything, and I'm not on deadline. Now, the feeling of being on deadline, you know that sense, right? I mean,
sure, yeah.
Just imagine that being removed from your life. Mm-hmm. I've slept better the past few nights, and yeah, I mean, and then, you know, yeah, I'd love to write some more, and, you know, maybe there's radio commentary in my future. Who knows, right?
Just sort of thinking back to your time at the Sentinel, you mentioned a couple of personal stories that were obviously tough for you to share, but important because, you know, to your point, they kind of show that the critic, the reporter, is a human being like everyone else.
Right.
What has been the most challenging aspect of this job?
Well, there's just so much material. I mean, there's just so much material, and you know. You write a lot, you know. So the workload, I guess, has in recent years has been the biggest challenge. I mean, there's this story, then there, you know, there's a TV story, then there's a radio story, then somebody's coming to town, and you're balancing a lot of assignments. I want to share this one thing that Henry Maldonado. Do you know that name?
Oh, sure, yeah, of course.
You know that name. He used to be the general manager at WKMG, and then he moved over to NZN, and he sent me this note, and this, I very much value this note. He said, "You had a great run. You have been one of the people who defined television in this town, and we loved you and hated you, but always read you. And that, what more do you want? I mean, if people say they respect you, that's like the greatest feeling in the world.
Well, Hal Bodeker, former TV critic at the Orlando Sentinel, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Welcome.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Monica Seely. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us online. We're at wmfe.org/intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. You can follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening.